Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. Good morning, everybody. Every retreat can start off with a time of adjustment and settling in. Usually the first few days is just settling in and adjusting to a new routine, a new place, being in a monastery is probably quite different for all of you. There's a new routine, daily schedule, different bed than you're used to. So please just be patient during this time of settling in. It's best to just give yourself plenty of compassion around how it takes time to stabilize, I guess, just like your emotions or your just like your energy. When we live a life that's quite busy, quite active, there's a momentum that creates in our mind and in our thinking. So it's going to take a little time for that momentum to settle into the spirit of this retreat. Even if you find it's not easy or difficult or challenging, you deserve a lot of credit and praise, even that you made these efforts to come here. You made these efforts to make space in your life for mindfulness, space in your life for peace. A lot of people will agree, mindfulness is good, peace is good, but making the time for it, that's another level right there. So I say excellent that you did that. So there's another thing to, I guess, watch here is we want to have a sense of sincere effort, but maybe stop short of getting too serious, though. If we have too strong of a willfulness or too strong of a determination, it turns into like this overly serious attitude. Okay, and now Peter, we're not serious at all. Well, that's no good either. If we don't take anything seriously, that's no good either. So somewhere in the middle is a balanced sense of a sincerity to practice, making an effort. And then whenever things are kind of going nicely, notice that and just be like, okay, this is kind of a nice time right now. Hopefully nothing's in pain for you right now. You know? Maybe there's whenever things are going nice and easy and steady, appreciate that. That's good. Just enjoy that time. There will be challenges ahead of you, I promise, on these, till the 20th. If you're having an easy time, enjoy it while it lasts. The next challenge is probably coming in the next hour or so. So practice is kind of funny that way, how, we're all sitting here so nicely, everyone's quiet, and you might look around you and think, wow, everybody's so controlled, and, they really have their act together, but my mind is just all crazy. There must be something wrong with me. And I assure you, that's in everybody's mind. It's not just your mind. We're all making a good show of it, of being calm, but what's inside our mind, that's another thing. Settling down the mind is surprisingly challenging and tricky. I always find whenever I would go on retreats, like as a lay person or even as a junior monk, it still happens to me even a little bit now, but it's easier. Whenever I'm on a retreat, that's when I tend to get my very best ideas. Or at least, it seems like my best ideas. I'm like, oh, well, now that I took the time to relax and took the time to kind of clear my mind. Oh, now the very best ideas came to my mind now. I can't wait to go do these ideas. I can't wait to get started on a new project, or actually more than one project. I have many good ideas. Okay? The mind has all these tricks like that. So be prepared that your mind is probably not going to cooperate all that easily. It's going to come up with reasons why you have something better to do than this practice. So maybe this is a perfect moment to talk about the first of the five indriyas, faith, or sadha, faith. Okay, so no matter what tricks your mind plays on you to not do this meditation, you have to have some stubbornness here and come back to the meditation. So that is basically what faith is. It's a trust and a confidence that this method can help you if you stick with it. You had to have some measure of faith to even come here. So you're already developing some faith. That's good. Okay, so these first few days of the retreat, you're especially going to need some faith while you settle into this new routine, settle into this new schedule, and you adjust to a new way of doing things, even a new way of relating to your own, your body, your senses. That's going to take faith. Because this will go against your normal habits. Okay, so that's kind of that's the warning I need to tell you right from the beginning. These first 2 days are... Don't expect any deep and peaceful meditations, at least, you know, on these first 3 days. It's more like just like survive these first 3 days. That's more like it. Okay, now I want to talk a little more generally about the five indriyas before I get into them. So why do we call it the five indriyas? What's up with this word indriya? So this word has its origin in the Hindu god Indra, or Inda. In the suttas, occasionally the god Inda is mentioned. In fact, one of our morning chants here had the word Inda in it. So back at the time of the Buddha, basically everybody would have known who Indra was. So Indra was sort of like the god of thunder. And they actually believed that, you know, when there was thunder and lightning, there was this god up on the clouds throwing the lightning bolts down onto the ground. So that was Indra. And pretty much every ancient civilization will have some kind of a thunder god. For the Greeks, it was Zeus. Here in Malaysia, you can buy a Zeus coffee. So when you drink one of those coffees, it's like you got a thunderbolt in your hand. It's like lightning in a cup. Okay? Just don't drink too much of it. Now, when we talk of the indriyas, the suggestion here is like, if you can learn these five things, it is like you gain godlike powers. This is godlike power, if you can learn this. There are several suttas that say you can even attain nibbana if you learn these five things. And in Buddhism, when you're an arahant, when you attain nibbana, that's even better than being a deity. That's better than a god. That's even better than Indra, if you could be an arahant. So throughout the course of this retreat, when I give Dhamma talks, I'm going to be drawing upon several suttas about the five Indras. It's not just Indriyas. It's not only in one sutta. It's in a whole bunch of suttas. Now, most of these suttas are going to be coming from this one book in the Pali Canon, this one book in the early Buddhist texts called the Samyutta Nikaya, or Samyutta Nikaya. I don't have a copy with me, but maybe I'll bring a copy one of these mornings to show you what that book looks like. It's a big, thick book from the early Buddhist texts. And in it, Samyutta means like connected, the connected discourses. And it has these chapters, big chapters, and each chapter is on like a theme. And one of those chapters is on the indriyas, or the faculties. Indriya sometimes is translated into faculties. So there's dozens of suttas all about the five indriyas in there. And I've picked, seven, eight, nine, kind of favorites out of there, which show different aspects of it. So maybe I'll just start with a very short sutta which just lists the five of them. This is kind of the simplest presentation of it. Okay, this is Samyutta Nikaya 48.8. So the Buddha speaking, Bhikkhus, there are these five faculties. What five? The faculty of faith, the faculty of energy, the faculty of mindfulness, the faculty of concentration, and the faculty of wisdom. Okay, so I briefly mentioned the first one, faith or sadha. So again, that's like, faith can mean like faith in a teaching, faith in a teacher, faith in a method, but it also means like a confidence as well. It also applies when you have already done something and you know it works. And because you know it works, it gives you a confidence. You can just do it again. Okay, so faith isn't just a prospective, optimistic hope. A lot of times people use faith only in that way. Okay, like I have faith they will feed lunch today. Okay, but I don't know. I don't know if they'll actually do it. It's just I hope they will. So there's faith like that. And then there's faith like I have confidence, you know, that if I meditate in this way, it will lead to peace. And I've been a monk a long time. I know I can do this, you know. There's a confidence like that. That's also sadha. Another thing about sadha is that confidence can be in ourselves. Knowing that we can trust ourselves, knowing that we have competency, knowing that we've kind of proved to ourselves what we are capable of. So like a healthy self-confidence, we could also call that sadha. Although I would say, just don't take it too far where it starts getting egotistical, okay? Then we do wrong by the teaching of anatta, not self. Okay, if we start getting too arrogant or too domineering or too maybe even a little snobby, you know, these are all hints that we're taking this confidence too far. It's getting egotistical. Then we need to tone it down to just a healthy self-confidence. Okay? If we have too little self-confidence, that's also not good. If we feel very self-deprecating or very like low self-esteem or always too timid, always too passive. Okay, so like low self-confidence, that's no good either. Okay, so somewhere in the middle there is a healthy self-esteem, healthy self-confidence. And I say we can call that sadha as well, confidence, the healthy kind. If any of you are parents, perhaps you can relate that when a child is young and you're raising the child, you need to teach the kid some self-confidence. Children sometimes are not very confident as they learn things for the first time. They need support, they need care, they need love. Kids need to be taught some self-confidence because it's not like automatic. Interestingly, parents do need to support their kids with that. Okay, so that's sadha, faith. So placing trust where we should place trust. Placing confidence where we should place confidence. Okay, so the second one is virya. Oftentimes translated as energy. Although that is perhaps not the best word. This is one of those tricky words that doesn't translate into English all that well. The Buddha doesn't give all that good of a definition of it. He just sort of assumes you know what he's talking about when he says energy. He will oftentimes say things like, well, yes, you have to have it. If your energy is too low, that's no good. And if you have too much energy, that's no good either. The mind will be restless. Okay, too little energy, you will have the hindrance of sloth and torpor. Too much energy and you'll be restless. The hindrance of restlessness. So there's a balance in between. And he doesn't say all that much about what you should do to have that even energy. But he will say things like, well, you know, you should know what to do, you know. He just sort of trusts you to know how to do that. I would suggest, things like good sleeping habits, good eating habits. Yoga can help a lot too, or exercise can help a lot too. There's no gym here at the monastery, but maybe you can sneak a little bit of yoga when no one's looking in your room. But if we are honest with ourselves, we can fairly easily take stock of, what sorts of activities do we do that drain our energy? And can we minimize those if they are not necessary? There's actually a lot of things in our life which drain our energy, but maybe we're not that wise about avoiding those things. I don't know about you, but whenever there's like sweet desserts put out at the meals, that's one of the fastest ways to lose all my energy. Sugar. Any sugary dessert drains my energy. I'm so tired afterwards. I would suggest the easiest thing you can do, if you want good energy on this retreat, and I can get you to change just one thing. Avoid sugar. Just for this time you're here. Whatever cake and pie and cookies and whatever, just avoid it. So the Buddhist teaching around energy, it's very much like, there's a phrase we have in English, do the right thing. Do the right thing. And you might wonder, well, what is the right thing? And I'm like, well, you should figure that out. What's the right thing? whatever the right thing is, do that. Yeah, so Viri is like, do the right thing. To keep your energy nice and even. Okay, so next one is sati, or mindfulness. So there's many, many methods of how to meditate, many objects of meditation. The Buddha teaches quite a few different possible objects of meditation in the early Buddhist texts. The most commonly taught objects of meditation are mindfulness of body or mindfulness of breath. I actually find mindfulness of breath doesn't work all that well for me. I don't really teach it very much. But mindfulness of body works much better for me. And when I have awareness of my torso, and I can feel my torso expanding and contracting with the breath, that's kind of how I add breath in there. My breath is happening inside my body. it's part of the bodily awareness. That's how I like to do it personally. But if I just pay attention to only my breath, I find it's just somehow too boring. My mind will go wandering really easily. And I feel that when we choose an object of meditation which is suitable for us, it will keep us pleasantly occupied, okay? We want for our capacity to be like 100% engaged. And we can control how much we are being mindful of to nicely fill the 100%. I mentioned earlier this morning about using the object of awareness of space. And sometimes I'll use more space or less space, and I can kind of experiment a bit with how much space. Sometimes it's a lot of space. It's huge in all directions. And when I find that nice amount of space, it's just right. It feels good. It's easy to find the peacefulness. It's like I've found that right size, and I just stay with that size. And that size might be a little different from day to day. It isn't always the same size every day. Some days it's more, some days it's less. So there is some adjustability in how we meditate, I say. If you're doing mindfulness of body, you might do a small area as you scan around. Or you might do a larger area. It needs to keep you pleasantly occupied. It needs to feel right. And when you can comfortably stay in the present moment, that's good. That's what you're looking for. A persisting mindfulness in the present. Better yet, you feel some peace to go with it too. Okay, so that leads to the next one here. Samadhi, the fourth indriya. Sometimes translated as concentration. Well, it's only day two here, so I won't get too deep into this topic, but all this meditating is hopefully leading to samadhi. It's like a heavenly, it starts off as like a heavenly peacefulness. It starts as a Brahma Vihara, let's say loving kindness, or metta, compassion, or karuna, mudita, or sympathetic joy, or upeka, which is sometimes translated as wisdom or equanimity. And then when it gets stronger, then it becomes a jhana. Okay, and then there's these first jhana, second jhana, third, fourth, and so on. It's a little too early to be getting into those yet. If it weren't for samadhi, if it weren't for these feelings of peace, it would be challenging to stay motivated to do all this meditating. with samadhi, we get kind of like a reward, you know? We get like happy juices for doing it. We feel uplifted, we feel inspired, we feel joyous even. I would suggest that even if your practice is not arriving to that progress, you know, yet, it's still highly valuable. It's still highly valuable. It's highly valuable to train the mind to not wander so much. I remember when I first meditated. I think it was in about 1997 when I was first introduced to Buddhism and meditation. And I started off doing Vipassana style meditation. And even though in those early times I couldn't attain to any Brahmaviharas or anything like that, it was still tremendously valuable in my life. I only had the willpower to do it, 5 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day. I'd never been on any retreat yet. But it made a huge difference in my life. I became a lot less distracted and a lot less just kind of aimless, and I began to make better decisions. I made better decisions about just day-to-day living. Even just decisions like taking better care of myself. Decisions about maybe eating better. Or just decisions about avoiding really kind of pointless wastes of time. And doing things that were more useful, beneficial. Just like mature, you know? I started making some more mature decisions. Just because of that 5 or 10 minutes of meditating. It helped in so many ways. It made my relationships better with people. I became a better listener to other people. I became more careful about my speech. I would pause more before I would speak. Considered my words. And speaking a little more wisely. So there's a lot of benefits we can get from meditating. Even if we don't get, you know, the Brahmaviharas or the jhanas, there's a lot of gain, I say, right? Even from the start. When I would study for exams, I would learn better. When I would take the exams, I would do better on the exam, get better marks. Things went better at my jobs. I got along better with the people at work. Got along better with my boss. There's so many ways it helps, I say. Just from sorting out my scattered mind made a big difference. Okay, and then number five of the five indriyas, panya, translated as wisdom. If you can stay in a state of upeka all the time, equanimity, that is what wisdom looks like when it's kind of perfected. Even if you're around other people or you're doing other things, if you can stay in equanimity all the time, that's one's pretty much an arahant if you can do that. That's what wisdom will look like when it ripens up. An arahant can stay in a brahmavihara pretty much all the time. It's within easy reach of them. So after we do all this meditating, we put in all these good causes which support our practice. We stop being so attracted to all the things of the world, all the distractions and all the attachments. And when our practice, when it bears fruit, when we achieve the brahmaviharas or the jhanas, and not just once, like on a regular basis, by the way, if you have an experience like that on this retreat, if you break through and you feel the heavenly peace of the brahmaviharas, or you feel a jhana and oh, it just blows you away with bliss, that's awesome. But be careful to go concluding, I must be a Sotapanna now. I must be a Sakadagami now. I must be an Anagami now. Surely I'm an Arahant now. Okay, watch out. That is a common mistake, is to conclude that too early. The question is, can you, whatever amazing thing happened to you, can you do that again? And can you do that on a regular basis for the rest of your life? Something, maybe not the exact same experience, but comparable, similar experiences. That peace you experienced, you want to be revisiting it over and over again. That's what the arahants can do, is they have this well-developed, well-established, well-practiced kind of access to it. It's part of their normal life. It wasn't just this one-off fluke, you know, it wasn't this one-off high moments of their life, but never again. Okay, so if those experiences happen to you, that's awesome, and you should rejoice. You should be very happy about that. But then the question is, okay, well, whatever you were doing, can you keep doing that? Yes, you must have been doing it right. How were you practicing? What led up to that? You must have been doing something right. What was your technique like? Maybe you need to do that more. What led up to that? That is something for you to develop more. Keep doing that. Keep working on that. You know, you've made your first steps. But now you got to establish that. You got to cultivate that. Okay, and then as one gets more and more familiar with doing this, more and more skilled, and this can easily take years, okay, or decades. In the suttas, there are some rare occasions where there are different spiritual seekers, sometimes even lay people, and they break through right away and attain Nibbana fast. Okay, the odd, rare person can do that. But most of us, it's going to take time. And probably decades, you know. If you are lucky, it will merely take years, okay? Even if it just takes you years, you're one of the lucky ones. Okay, I'd say the average person is looking at, like, decades here. But so what? It's still worth it. It's still worth it. And I say every step you take is rewarded. Even if it's to have a more calm mind, clear mind, to have better decision making, even better people skills. If that's all you get out of this is better people skills, that was still well worth it, I say. That'll benefit you in all kinds of ways. Okay, so as this practice kind of matures, then we become better at attaining to the Brahmaviharas, even when we're not in formal meditation. Okay, maybe we can do it like in the shower. That's high practice if you can do that. Or maybe while you're eating. Or maybe while you're sweeping. Or maybe while you're just walking in a park or something. If you can attain to the Brahmaviharas in those kinds of situations, yes, that is high practice. You've come a long way once you can do that. So that's this number five, the punya, the wisdom. It's like, can you integrate not just mindfulness, but mindfulness which culminates in that peace, the peace of heart, the peace of the Brahmaviharas, even outside of formal practice, okay? Even when you're around other people. If you want to know what the hardest situation is, to have all this peace, I'm going to say it's around your family. The Buddha never says this in the suttas, but I've talked to many other monks and nuns, and they all will agree, you know, no matter how much you meditate at the monastery, no matter how much your practice gets all like peaceful and awesome, just wait. You go home and visit your family. And all that peace is going to be gone. You're going to wonder where it went. Okay? That's pretty much the hardest situation, is your family. There's the thing about being in a family, like there's a very strong kind of a habitual, it's like a habitual energy that the family has. And it's very easy to just kind of go back to that same habitual way that you have been conditioned. You were conditioned that way since you were born, okay? Your parents conditioned you that way. You grew up that way. It's actually deeply, deeply conditioned into you. So if you can meditate differently, you know, despite that powerful conditioning, you are kind of like a master. You know, that's why it's so hard, because it's deeply conditioned. Okay, your parents were already conditioning you when you were in the crib. Okay, you're still wearing diapers. They were conditioning you with that kind of family, you know, vibe, okay? Yeah.